question was, does God do things like provide you with parking places when you need them? And I said, yes, he does. Happened today with our family. We had all these treats for the class, and I said, boy, we need a spot that's really close to the door. And the one that was closest to the door opened up just as we arrived. A miracle of God. But God does do that. Got to see it for ourselves. And the second question is right on the topic of this class. You know, we have this Genesis flood, and we're going to be talking about the extent of the flood today. Is there any geological evidence for the Genesis flood? What do you say? Geological evidence for the flood. Yeah, think carefully. Yeah, that's it. There is no geological evidence for the flood. Okay, why? Okay, it wasn't that big, but much more important than the size of the flood, it wasn't that long. You know, a lot of people think that the evidence for a flood is based on the size of the flood. It's much more important is the length of the flood. You know, we got a huge amount of evidence for a flood that covered the entire Mississippi Valley. I don't know why. It remained flooded for 200 million years. That's why you got so much evidence for a flood there. How long was the Genesis flood? Okay, about a year. Yeah, if you checked it, I should give this as a little quiz. Why don't you open your Bible right now and figure out, one, how long did the floodwaters come upon the face of the earth, and how long did it take for the floodwaters to recede? First one that gets it, raise your hand. You got it? 6 months for the floodwaters coming down or for the floodwaters receding? Okay, I'm asking two questions. The first one I think is pretty easy. 40 days and 40 nights. Everybody remembers that. For 40 days and 40 nights, the waters came upon the face of the earth. How long did it take for those waters to leave? Yeah, you can figure out exactly. All right, he's getting it. Okay, yeah, it's not quite as easy as it looks. You're close. Actually gives it to you to the exact day if you want to work your way all the way through it. That's real close. About a year is usually what most people say. More accurately, it's about 11 months. If you want to really accurately, it's 335 days. Okay? But it doesn't pop off the page to you. You kind of work your way through it. That's why if you go out in the streets and ask people, how long did it take the flood to disappear? You'll get about 15 different answers. The 40 days and the 40 nights, hey, even people who haven't read the Bible seem to know that one. That's well publicized. That's right. It's in a song. So, okay, that was before my time, but regardless. I lived in Canada, right. They didn't sing those songs in Canada. So, but I thought I'd get away with it, you know. But yeah, because you have to, as you got to see here, people had to kind of work through four different pieces of the flood account to figure out how many days. A lot of people have no idea how many days. And moreover, a lot of people don't recognize that 335 days just isn't very long to leave any kind of a flood deposit. It was probably long enough to leave a small deposit. The problem is within a few years, you wouldn't have any evidence of it at all. Yeah, it gets taken care of by other geological reactions that are more significant. And certainly 20, 30,000 years later, there isn't any hope of finding evidence for that flood. What is interesting is if you go into the Mesopotamia Valley, you do see lots of flood deposits. Those are floods that lasted a lot longer. They probably weren't as deep. You know, I believe that the Genesis flood was probably somewhere between 300 and 600 feet deep of water. But it only lasted 335 days once that water was there. 375 days total. And there were floods in Mesopotamia that were longer lasting than that, and that's the evidence you see, but it dates to the wrong time. So, in fact, one researcher claims to find evidence for 6 flood deposits. The flood deposits they see tend to be relatively small. They don't cover the entire Mesopotamia Valley. They're smaller than that. And, they were floods that lasted longer than the flood we see in Scripture. So that's why most geologists who examine the area say, well, there's definitely flood deposits there, but it's impossible to identify any of them with a Genesis flood. And given how brief the flood is, we really don't expect there to be a significant deposit remaining from that flood. In the back. Okay. We haven't really gotten into that. How to date the Genesis flood. I threw 20 to 30,000 years. That was based on the Vela supernova eruption. That's not a very accurate date. Moreover, we can't conclusively prove that Vela is the one that's responsible for shortening our lifespans. It seems to have something to do with it, because certainly the Vela supernova vastly increased the cosmic rays we're exposed to. And those cosmic rays make it theoretically impossible for us to live beyond 120 years. So that's a good clue. A better clue that we'll be approaching will be the opening and closing of land bridges. Because what we notice in Genesis chapter 11 is relatively soon after the flood, you've got the forced spread of humanity over the face of the earth. And it was these land bridges that enabled this spread of humanity into Australia, England, North and South America. And today we have tools for quite accurately dating when those bridges form and when they collapse. And particularly with the bridges that are significant for North and South America, those that connected Siberia to Alaska, the west coast of British Columbia to Vancouver Island and Queen Charlotte's, the bridge that would connect Newfoundland. Those dates we can date fairly precisely. And so that gives you a date that says the flood must be previous to that. And that would back the flood before roughly 11 to 12,000 years ago. And then the bridge forming to Australia, that looks like it's in the neighborhood of 15 to 30,000 years ago. So those are the dates. But you know what? It's not very accurate. And if you ask me this date, how do you get it from the Bible? The Bible's date for the Genesis flood is no more accurate than the Bible's date for God creating Adam and Eve, which means you can pin it down to about a factor of 5 or 10. That's all. So, with Adam and Eve, it was 10 to 60,000 years ago. I got asked in the radio this week, well, what's the biblical date for the flood? And I says, well, I would put it between 10 and 50,000 years ago. Still not a very accurate date. Now, why is the Bible so imprecise on the dates for Noah, the flood, and Adam and Eve? Anybody? Yes. The event is what is important, not the date. That's true. In terms of what God's trying to teach us in the book of Genesis, the events are far more important than the date. But why is it that we can't nail down that date very precisely? The Bible does give us a clue. What's the clue you get? Just a clue. The genealogy. The genealogies give you a clue, but they only give you a clue. They don't give you an exact date, as some Christian interpreters have claimed. Why? They skip generations. You can prove that they skip generations. Can you give me a couple of examples? Yes.
Pastor today said, Jesus, son of David.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good example. Skipped a lot of generations. Right? In fact, if you go into Matthew, he's called the son of Adam. So you can skip all the way from Adam right up to Jesus and Joseph. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I got this in my margin note here. It's in the Genesis question, but I think I also stuck it in the margin. Yeah, here it is. Let's take the example of Genesis 5, because that's the one where people say, hey, doesn't this give you an exact number of years between Adam and Noah? When Methuselah had lived 187 years, he became the father of Lamech. Here's an alternate way to read it. When Methuselah had lived 187 years, he became the father of the line that ended in Lamech. Okay, so that gives you two different possibilities. Well, for example, I use the ages here in Genesis 5 as one piece of evidence that these lifespans that are mentioned here are recorded in the kinds of years that we experience. And that may be one reason why it's left in the text. You may have recalled, this was many months ago we covered this, but if you're trying to claim, for example, that they were counting years differently, and he really didn't live any longer than we did, then you would take 912, which is the average. What's our average? About 80. Okay, that means that you'd have to shorten everything down by about 1/11. And you notice two of the gentlemen mentioned here in the genealogies give birth to a son when they're 65. Okay, divide 65 by 11. What do you get? You get 5. All right? Is it really rational for someone to give birth to a son when they're 5 years of age? A man giving birth to a man at 5, that's impossible. Can't be done. So, on that basis, you would argue that these are real lifespans, real years, and they really did live to be 912. And it's hard to really interpret Genesis 6, where it speaks about the shortening of lifespans if they weren't living considerably longer. Okay. So, that may be one. There may be other reasons why it's listed this way. But one reason that so many Bible interpreters believe that we have to translate it, he became the father of the line that ended in Lamech, is because you can compare these Genesis 5 and 11 genealogies with genealogies in the New Testament. The genealogies in the New Testament have more names in them. Okay, some say it's a name that was a copying error. The thing I noticed is, in talking this over with leading Hebrew and Greek scholars of the canon of Scripture, is that not very many would claim that it's a copying error. I mean, every Bible I pick up, whatever, I got 16 different translations. They all include that name in Luke 3, that extra name of Canaan that is stuck into the text. It's in every single translation. So, okay. All right, last week I promised that we would kind of zoom through this and see if we can actually finish this. And we've been trying to get through these 17 different reasons why the flood is universal but not global, making the distinction between a universal and global terminology in the Bible. Probably the best example you have there is the one in Genesis chapter 8, where it speaks about Noah seeing the hills and mountains as the waters recede. He releases the dove, and the context of the dove, it says there was water over all the face of the earth. So here we have the example of water covering the entire face of the earth in the context of the dove, but not in the context of Noah. Universal does not have to be equivalent to global. The limited extent of sin, the principle here is that God never pours out his judgment wrath to any greater extent than the limits of human reprobation. And if human reprobation had not yet visited Antarctica and Greenland, then there'd be no need to flood Greenland and Antarctica. And we got lots of evidence to conclude that human beings indeed had not gotten that far. The limited water supply, you can't cover all the mountains with the water that exists on the face of the earth. The text tells us that the waters of the flood, Genesis 7, came from sources on the earth. Not extraterrestrial sources, but earth-based sources. And those sources simply don't add up to enough to generate a global flood. And those who would claim that the mountains are worn down to a very smooth level, or no mountains really existed until the time of the flood, you got the problem that you've got to pop up these mountains from, say, a few hundred feet to 30,000 feet in the course of just 335 days. And that's a lot of tectonics to pack into just 335 days, enough that you would argue you wouldn't even find splinters in the ark, and you wouldn't be able to find any pieces of flesh in the people on board the ark with that kind of vigorous plate tectonic activity going on in just 335 days. And actually, it's worse than that, because those who would posit a global flood interpretation also have to explain the continental drift. I mean, I've noticed that global flood proponents do acknowledge that the evidence for continental drift is overwhelming, namely the evidence for a supercontinent breaking into seven continents. Now you've got to pack up to 6,000 miles of plate tectonics into just 335 days. How many of you have had the opportunity to feel the impact of 2 inches of plate tectonics? Okay, what does 2 inches feel like? Kind of terrifying. Okay, what you do is you take 6,000 miles, divide by 2 inches, and there's the extra energy you got released in that tectonic movement. And obviously, you're going to have a difficult time even preserving the atmosphere in the ocean, let alone the ark and its inhabitants. Number five, we have the command given twice in Scripture, Genesis 1 and Genesis 9, that human beings were to fill the whole face of the earth. And it's quite clear from the context of both Genesis 9 and the chapters following Genesis 1 that the human race had failed the biblical or the divine mandate to fill the whole earth. They had remained in one place, and now God was judging them for their failure to fulfill his command to spread out over the whole face of the earth. And we notice in Genesis chapter 11 that we still have the human race after two explicit commands refusing to spread out from Mesopotamia. Let us remain in one place, in one city, with this tower, so that we will not be scattered over the face of the earth, that we can remain as one people, united in peace and harmony. Problem is, human beings will always use peace and harmony if they're not submitted to the authority of Jesus Christ for evil purposes, not for good purposes. We'll spend some time looking at the benefit of having nations that must compete for citizens. Just like it's good to have corporations competing for customers, it's good that we have nations competing for citizens. A couple of weeks ago, we looked at the problem, last week I guess it was, that the text does not deal with the lower animals. In terms of those creatures that were brought on board the ark, we see seven Hebrew nouns that are used throughout Genesis 6, 7, 8, and 9. And there's nothing in the lexical definitions of those seven different Hebrew nouns that would compel us to interpret the animals on board the ark any more broadly than birds and mammals that have had contact with human beings. In other words, there is no need for Noah to bring on board the ark amphibians or insects or reptiles or, for that matter, polar bears and emperor penguins. No need to bring those creatures on board because they're not part of those species of life that were damaged by human sin. And that's something you see in the Levitical law, is that only birds and mammals that have had contact with human beings can be damaged by human sin. We do not have any damage upon the behavior of amphibians by our sin or of insects. You probably observed that. And we also note that only nine nouns are used for those creatures that are destroyed by the flood. And again, except for two words, Yakum, and I forget the other one, I'll have to look it up. Sherez and Yakum, thank you. Is there any need to interpret this any more broadly than birds and mammals that have had contact with the human race? The reason why you see Yakum and Sherez included is that like it was in Sodom and Gomorrah, like it was in Jericho, it's really impossible to wipe out all the birds and mammals without also destroying quite a few cockroaches and flies and mosquitoes that are hanging around these human habitations. And so there would be some collateral damage. You say, well, why would God include the destruction of those creatures? Hey, those are animals that are going to be very easily reintroduced into the region of damage. The reason why God said, let's not bother with the house flies inside the city of Jericho, he knew they wouldn't have to wait very long for the house flies to start coming back into that region. Same thing with Sodom and Gomorrah. Those are creatures that are very effective at repopulating empty habitats. The same is not true of deer or antelope or cows, goats. When you start looking at the birds and mammals, these are slow, these are species that are very slow in populating an empty habitat. No place names beyond Greater Mesopotamia up until Genesis chapter 10. And you know, as we finished off last week, this is kind of where we ended, is that as you go through the first nine chapters of Genesis, it's amazing how few geographical place names you have, and the ones you do have are all right there within Mesopotamia. So just as a matter of quick review, what are the place names you find from Genesis 1 through Genesis 9? Geographical place names, yes. You got the land of Nod, and that we were told the land of Nod was where? East of Eden. Okay, that means Eden's another one, right? Okay, but Eden is identified. We're told that Eden is in that region where you get four great rivers coming together. Okay, remember the names of the rivers? Tigris, the Euphrates, the Pishon. There's one more. That's it. Okay. But you know, those last two you can pretty well forget about because nobody's ever identified them. And as we showed in a map last week, the reason why you see more than just the Tigris and the Euphrates is that the two traditional locations for the Garden of Eden, southern Mesopotamia and up here in northern Mesopotamia, are regions where the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers come very close together. In fact, what you see down here even today is that the Tigris and Euphrates River splits into a number of major tributaries even when you're far away from the delta that pours into the Persian Gulf. And so you could easily see the ancients assigning different names to these places. I mean, like here, for example, you got the Tigris and Euphrates joining together here. They joined together here. In ancient times, they joined together as far as far north as up here. So where they join together, you actually would have four rivers, four different names if you name all the tributaries, the two that come in, the two that leave. And so that's been identified as one possible location of the Garden of Eden. But up here as well, you got the potential for crossover of the Tigris-Euphrates rivers. That probably explains the use of the four names. Okay. Any other geographical place names in the first nine chapters? Yes. Yes, the mountains of Ararat. Okay, anything else? You got the mountains of Ararat, you got the land of Nod, you got the Garden of Eden, you got these four rivers. You got the city of Enoch. Okay, that again is unidentified, and we have no idea where it is. And that's it. You now have exhausted the whole list of geographical place names. Notice there's no mention of the Mediterranean. There's no mention of the Nile. There's no mention of the Persian Gulf or the Caspian Sea. So, I mean, anything out here is just not mentioned. Now then, pardon me? Babylon? That's later. Okay, once you get after the flood, then it mentions the six cities of the plain. And on this map, I've actually identified the different cities that are mentioned as being built by Nimrod's generation, which is at least four generations after Noah, might be many more generations after Noah. So these cities are mentioned. But then you turn to Genesis chapter 10. What do you see in Genesis chapter 10? It's an amazing chapter compared to the first nine chapters. Yeah. I mean, you have only a few geographical place names mentioned in the first nine chapters. Then you turn to Genesis chapter 10, and the entire chapter is nothing but geographical place names. I mean, that's what you basically see. It talks about this table of nations. It mentions all these peoples, and it mentions the territories in which they lived. And so now you've got a textbook or a chapter that deals with geography. Almost no geography in the first nine chapters. When you get to Genesis chapter 10, it's almost entirely geography. And when you look at the table of nations, it's in the context of God scattering. It's a little bit out of chronological sequence because it's in Genesis 11 that it tells us a story of what got the peoples to move out of Mesopotamia into all the parts of the earth. This is where God forcibly scatters them. But it's in Genesis 10 that it tells us where they were scattered to. What you have in Genesis 11 is God saying he's going to take each group of people, each people group, and establish them in their territory with their language. So they have their language and their territory. What you have in Genesis 10, it talks about the different heads of the different people groups and identifies the geography that's been assigned to them for them to live. But as you go down the list, now it's global in context. Genesis 10 is the first time that you see references for people living beyond the realm of Mesopotamia, and be careful, go through it all. It literally covers the entire globe. Yes. The cities in Genesis chapter 11 that were built by Nimrod. Yeah, we think we've got most of them identified because these cities were built, destroyed, or burnt to the ground and rebuilt on the same location. And like, for example, when you go into Nineveh or Babylon, you see many different cities that were built on top of one another. One city being knocked down to a pile of rubble, then they just build on top of the rubble and set up another city. Then that gets knocked down. Now, that may not be the case for all six, but particularly when you look at Nineveh and Babylon, those are the only two places in the world that those place names are ever used. So that's why most archaeologists believe that, the location of at least those two cities out of the six that Nimrod have built are well identified in terms of locale. The others also may be well identified. They're just not quite as certain. Well, I mean, we see the six different names that you see there in Genesis 11 surrounding Nimrod's generation. We have archaeological evidence that all six are within Mesopotamia. The reason I can't be as certain as with, say, Nineveh and Babylon is that, eliminating the possibility that the name might have been used twice. It's kind of like what happened here in North America. A bunch of people moved onto Manhattan Island. They called it New Amsterdam. Well, there's an Amsterdam in Europe. There's an Amsterdam here in the States. And then when the Brits took it over, they changed it to New York. But, hey, there's a city by the name of York in England. And as you know, here in North America, we have cities with the identical name. I grew up in Canada, and there they've got a city called London. And where is it? They got it in Ontario on the Thames, okay? So they copy, and there's a Paris there. In fact, the joke in Ontario is that every capital of Europe is represented by some city in Ontario itself. So there's a Berlin, there's a Paris, and that may have happened in the Middle East area, that as people moved out, they took the city name with them. In the case of Babylon and Nineveh, we're quite certain that's not the case. But in the more obscure ones, that possibility might be there. Most scholars think not. So the answer is, the majority opinion is, yeah, all six are there in Mesopotamia and didn't exist anywhere else. Yes. What is the evidence in Genesis that anybody ever got outside of Mesopotamia? What you got there in the 10th chapter. We're intending to go into Genesis chapter 10 after we get through with the flood chapters, so we'll spend some time going through the geographical place names, the peoples that are mentioned there, and trying to figure out what's going on. It's of interest. Those of you that were with us when we went through the book of Revelation, I mean, we took 7 years to go through that book, we spent a little bit of time on Genesis chapter 10, because what you discover is that these people names and place names figure into end times prophecy. And so going back to Genesis 10 gives you an idea maybe about how these end times events will play out. you know, which peoples are involved in which conflicts. Well, Genesis 10 will give you some clue to that. So we'll spend a little bit of time identifying that. But yeah, the whole point is it actually talks about, you know, this family head taking his extended family out of Mesopotamia and moving to this locale and, you know, trying to set up a shop there. So, okay, there was another hand I missed. Maybe not. Okay, let's move on. Okay, number 8 and 9 are probably the strongest arguments that people put forward that the flood cannot possibly be local, but must be global. So let's just look at these two passages in particular. Genesis 7:19. I mean, I can't tell you how often the flood comes up when I'm doing a radio interview. It happened this past week. I was doing radio interview. I was on the radio yesterday. And, you know, this issue comes up. Doesn't Genesis 7:19 prove once and for all that the flood must be global? Well, let's just look at the passage and see what it says. Okay, it says, they rose greatly on the earth. Well, what does the they refer to? Back to verse 18, the waters of the flood. The waters of the flood rose greatly on the earth. So that means it's got to be more than a few inches. You know, there are those Christian interpreters who look at the flood account and say, well, it was a few feet of water and that was it. And then, you know, floods like that do happen, particularly in valleys like that. We've had floods like that happen in the San Joaquin Valley. Those of you around in the early 1970s, there was a flood in the San Joaquin Valley that was 4 feet deep, covered a huge area. And it took 4 months for that flood to recede. By the way, there's no deposit left from that flood. So I kind of remember we said earlier, you get a flood of several hundred feet, only lasts 335 days. You're not going to get much of a deposit. Hey, we had a huge flood in the San Joaquin Valley just 20 years ago, and today there's no evidence of that flood. It's all gone. Why? Because it was only 4 feet of water and only lasted 4 months. Okay, the floodwaters rose greatly on the earth, and all the high mountains under the entire heavens were covered. The waters rose and covered the mountains to a depth of more than 15 cubits. Every living thing that moved on the earth perished. Okay, people will quote that and say, Rudy, there's no other way to interpret that than a global flood. I could probably make this a review question, because I think we've covered this in some depth before. So if someone were to throw that at you, how would you respond and say, this does not necessarily prove that it's a global flood? By the way, I would agree with this. These sentences I just read to you would be consistent with a global flood, but they don't prove a global flood. Okay, how do you unravel it? Yes. Okay, the waters rose and covered the earth in the context of Noah on board the ark. So from his perspective, there's a lot of water coming upon the face of the earth. But what would be the limit of his horizon? 50 miles? Yeah, if he's sitting on top of the ark, he might be able to see as far away as 50 miles. Certainly not farther. It may be only just, actually, it's probably more like 20 miles that he could see. Because the ark just wouldn't be, even the top level of the ark wouldn't be that high above the water. Yeah, it won't be clear like it is, especially during the 40 days. You're not going to be seeing, you may only be able to see 20 feet or maybe just 5 feet, maybe even only 2 feet. But once the floods, the water start coming down from the sky, it might clear up like this. But even if it's a perfectly clear day, you're probably limited to about 20, 25 miles that you can see. If you get on a big high ladder, maybe you can see a little bit further. Every few feet you get up makes a huge difference. The waters rose, covered the earth. Okay, that's a good answer. He wouldn't be able to see water that far anyway. But as I say, it's got to be more than a few feet of water because it pushed the ark up. Noah and his family could feel the ark coming up under the floodwaters. And it's going to take quite a bit of water to float that ark. And it's going to take quite a bit of water so that all these seas from horizon to horizon for 300 some odd days is nothing but water. Yes. Right? How much is a cubit? Anywhere from 15 to 36 inches. Okay, if you go through the Bible, you'll find three cubits. You got the short cubit, which is like 17 and a half inches. You got the long cubit, which is 22 inches. And then you got the cubit you see in Ezekiel, the angelic cubit, which is 3 feet. So, but even that, that gives you anywhere from how many feet of water above these highest mountains? Well, it's about 21 feet on up to maximum of 45 feet. Okay, but I think where it gets people thinking this has got to be a global flood, that's 21 feet minimum above the high mountains. So Mount Everest is our highest mountain. That means it's 29,000 and a few feet plus 21 feet beyond that. Yes. That's correct. That's right. The word for earth takes on five different literal definitions that covers anything from the extent of your backyard to the entire planet. And the word har, that's translated mountains, can refer to a little hill, again, in your backyard, up to a towering peak. Does anybody hear of the King James translation? Or the New King James translation? Got New King James? Yeah, I think you'll get a different rendition of Genesis 7:19. I know that King James will translate it the hills. Okay, so New King James and the King James uses the word hill rather than the word mountain. And that's consistent with that word har. It can mean anything from a small hill to a towering peak. So there was enough flood waters to cover at least the low-lying hills. That's still a lot of water. Okay, but it may not be 30,000 feet of water. Okay, the other thing is you can unpack that Hebrew word for cover. The verb there is kasah, and it's got three different literal definitions. In this context, you can interpret it three different ways. The waters permanently covered for a period of almost a year these hills or mountains. Or it could be that that much water fell upon the hills. And so you've got 22 feet of water falling upon the hills. Or it could be 22 feet of water running over the hills, like in a flash flood. So those are the three different possibilities. Now, as an English reader digging into the Hebrew, you say, gee, wouldn't it have been nice if God had told us exactly which of the three options it is? Why is there no need for God to do that? To tell you whether these mountains were run over with water, rainfall fell upon them, or water remained upon them? Yes. The effect is exactly the same. You're going to wipe out all human beings, all their habitations, and all their birds and mammals, whether it's scenario one, scenario two, or scenario three. It makes no difference. Which scenario choose, you get the same impact. Every living thing that moved on the earth perished. You know, whenever I get hit with this on the radio by some global flood proponent, they always stop there. What I have to remind them is, that's the first half of the sentence. Read the rest of the sentence. Every living thing that moved on the earth perished. Birds, livestock, wild animals, and the creatures that swarm over the earth and all mankind. Okay, then you dig up into your Hebrew lexicon and say, what do those words really mean? Well, we looked at those words last week. Birds, that's pretty clear. Livestock, that's referring to the domesticated herbivores. The kai, the wild animals, this refers to those land mammals that are carnivores that we use as pets, they got wiped out. Mankind, again, the list here of all the, and by the way, every living thing that moved on the face of the earth, what's that word for every living thing? The word is basar. Remember that definition? Birds and mammals that have had some kind of contact with human beings. So when it says every living thing that moved on the face of the earth, that's all you read, and you're an English language reader, you get the idea, boy, that took care of all the beetles, that took care of all the amphibians, all the reptiles, all the birds and mammals, nothing was left. Even the ants and termites were wiped out. That's not what the text is really saying. It's the birds and mammals that have had contact with human beings. Then it breaks it down into its subcategories. Let me tell you what kinds. Yes. Well, you've got things called expanded translations that will get into translating these words with phrases rather than word for word. If you're going to translate word for word, yeah, you're going to not be able to precisely communicate the exact definition of what's there in the Hebrew original. An expanded translation, they can do that. They'll give you a phrase for a single word so you can more accurately figure what's going on. But the reason why you don't see very many expanded translations for the Old Testament compared to the New Testament, it's because in the Hebrew language, especially with the nouns, they have multiple literal definitions. So even an expanded translation, what you'd have to do, say you translate the word earth, is say, instead of earth, the entire planet, or an entire nation, or an entire continent, or an entire island, or a territory within that nation, or the private plot of an individual. So, yeah, it goes on forever. And you're always left with all these options. Well, gee, I got six options here, I got three options here, I got four options here. It makes it very difficult to read the text. Whereas in the Greek, you've got a language that's a lot closer to the English language, and therefore you can give an expanded definition and just have that one definition. So, for example, when you see the word love in the New Testament, in the Greek original, there's four different words for love. And so an expanded translation will tell you what that word is and give you the definition. And so that's where an expanded translation is of a lot of benefit. But it doesn't work well going from Hebrew to English because the English language has a vocabulary that's 1,000 times larger than Biblical Hebrew. Keep in mind, Biblical Hebrew has only 3,100 words total if you exclude the proper nouns. And hey, my theological word book of the Old Testament comes up with less than 3,100 words even when they include the major proper nouns. Just all they do is eliminate the minor proper nouns, and they still can't get past 3,100. Very tiny vocabulary. It's one of the smallest vocabulary languages that exists. And what do we have today? People going through the book of Genesis, they fight over the meanings of these words. Saying, well, you know, it says day. That's got to be 24 hours. Not realizing in the Hebrew, you've got three literal definitions for the word day. And by the way, people like the Apostle Paul understood this quite well about the Hebrew. Remember in Corinthians, he speaks about being taken up to heaven. What does he tell his reader? I was taken up to the third heaven. So the reader would realize, oh yes, the Hebrew word for heaven's got three different literal definitions. Paul's talking about definition three, not definition two or definition one. And, you know, we have these debates over Genesis inside the church. So seldom do we remind ourselves that, you know, we need to qualify which of the Hebrew definitions we're speaking about or where the text just simply doesn't specify which it is. And by the way, when it's really important, it will specify it, but not always in the exact verse. Now, I'll give you a good example of that. It tells us in Genesis 1:16, the stars, the sun, and the moon were made. Okay, there's no verb tenses in Hebrew. That simply means they were made some time ago in the past. Sounds ambiguous. You say, well, if they were made in the past, That means God made them on the fourth day, the third day, the second day, the first day, or in the beginning. Too bad he didn't tell us. Well, he didn't tell us in the context of the fourth creation day. But if you go back to the first verse, there it tells you. So if you're watching for it, you can pick it up. Okay. Any more questions on Genesis 7:19? Yes. Okay, Dead Sea Scrolls, because yes, as far as a complete manuscript of the Old Testament, the earliest one we have is 9th century A.D. That's the Masoretic text, and we have no manuscript that goes any earlier than that. Dead Sea Scrolls typically date to the 2nd century B.C. That's 11 centuries earlier than the Masoretic text. Now, what we have in those Dead Sea Scrolls are portions, or fragments more likely, of every Old Testament book. Okay, but there's only one book in the Old Testament from which the Dead Sea Scrolls gives us a complete text. And that's the book of Isaiah. For the book of Isaiah, you've got a Dead Sea Scroll that covers the entire book. And that revolutionized this whole debate about how much distortion took place in the making of copies of the Old Testament. Because, yeah, it was almost identical to the 9th century A.D. copy. In 11 centuries of history, there have been no significant changes to the text. And this is when Christians discovered just how careful these scribes were in making copies. Remember in the New Testament, we had the scribes and the Pharisees? These scribes, they were under the employ of the Jewish state simply to make copies of the Old Testament. That's all they did was make copies. Say, boy, what a cushy job. All I got to do is spend all my life making a few copies. Yeah. And they also had to make a note in the margin. You know, these scribes were highly educated Jews. They were the ones who were the most trained in literary works. And when they were making a copy, it took five of them to make a copy. One guy wrote out the copy. Two other scribes positioned themselves on the right shoulder behind the guy making the actual copy. Then there were two on the left shoulder. I mean, can you imagine that? And you're sitting there writing out a copy of this scroll, and you got four people sitting over your shoulders watching you. Well, what that did is encourage that guy making the copy not to make mistakes, okay? And he had four watching him all the time to see if he would make a slip. When he did make a slip, he had to note in the margin that he had made an error. Now, he would correct it, but there'd be a note in the margin, an error took place by scribe so-and-so. And he had to sign his name that he was responsible for the error. And then the four that were watching also had to sign their names. That this was a place where a copying error took place. And here we fixed it, and off they went. What really explains why in the course of 11 centuries there really weren't any significant errors transmitted because of how carefully they made their copies. God doesn't make any errors. By the way, in terms of New Testament copies, we don't have the same care. However, most scholars believe that the New Testament copies, likewise, are extremely reliable. And the difference with the New Testament is just the huge volume of copies. Whereas we have only a few copies that go back to the 9th century AD and earlier, of even portions of the Old Testament. In the case of the New Testament, we have copies dating to the 3rd and 4th century AD that add up to over 16,500 complete copies. So you've got this huge volume of these extant copies. And when you compare those 16,500, there are 40 words only in dispute. Scholars only dispute 40 words, and none of the 40 have any significant bearing in any of the teachings of any of the New Testament books. And in addition to those 16,500, you've got millions of fragments or portions of different books of the New Testament. Right. So when you run into a skeptic that says, you know, hey, we have this Bible, you know, it's been copied over and over again, you know, this is so fraudulent, I really don't have the pure word of God here, and why should I pay any attention? There is no other book in history for which we have such a wealth of manuscript evidence for its accuracy. By the way, just to complete this discussion, we can put this in some point of comparison. Okay, the Punic Wars. That was the wars that Rome fought with Carthage. And there were Roman historians who wrote out the history of that series of wars. Today, we have five copies of the Punic Wars. Only five. And the earliest one we have dates back to the 9th century A.D. Okay, now that's 12 centuries after the events took place. But because the five compare so well, now there are differences amongst the five, but because they compare so well, historians today, and because we have as many as five manuscripts, historians consider that to be a very accurate rendition of the historical events that make up the Punic Wars. I said, yeah, we accept this as truth because of the weight of the manuscript evidence. That's considered to be very well-established historical manuscript evidence, the fact that you got five, and they're only 11 centuries or 12 centuries away from the original. Okay, compare that with the New Testament. 16,500 complete manuscripts that are 3 centuries from the original, with fragments that date right back into the lifespans of some of the authors. For example, there is a fragment of the Gospel of John that dates to 119 A.D. Okay, when was the Gospel of John written? The early 90s A.D., which means we have a fragment that dates right back to the generation that would have seen the original. And it's almost impossible, it's considered impossible for a distortion to arise within the generation that witnesses the original. Someone would definitely have blown the lid and said, this is a mistake. Yes. It's possible it's earlier. Everybody agrees that it's certainly no later than 119 A.D. And by the way, about 2 years ago, a book was published to the effect that there are three. I think I shared this with you in the class some time ago. They found in an Egyptian Cairo back alley remnant. You know, if you go to Cairo, you've got these little shops set up on the street where they sell archaeological artifacts. And this one Christian picked up these papyrus scrolls and found that they were the Book of Matthew. And the dates he got in the papyrus scrolls were in the 60s A.D. So that may now rank as the earliest manuscript evidence we have for the New Testament. Okay, when was the Book of Matthew written? About 60 A.D. So this was very close to the original itself. So that's still being studied, but you know, I looked at the book. They got carbon 14 dates on this stuff. It's pretty decent. So that's only, you know, a few years. Yes. Yeah, the Dead Sea Scrolls are far more extensive than what we have today because they didn't know their value. Just like this guy in this back alley Cairo street vendor had no idea the value of these papyrus fabrics. He was just, the guy bought them for a few bucks. So, and it may be the most valuable find in biblical archaeology. Yes. Right. No, that's an excellent point. There are more flood accounts in the cultures of the world than there are creation accounts. Far more flood accounts than there are creation accounts. Every culture of the world has their flood story or their flood myth. And so, yeah, if you don't believe in the Genesis flood, how do you explain the fact that every people group has a flood story or a flood myth? The other thing that's really interesting, and we did this many years ago, you take these hundreds, and some scholars say there are thousands of flood stories. And what you do is you compare them to the Genesis flood account. And what you notice is the farther you get from the geography of Mesopotamia, in time and in place, the more distorted the account becomes relative to the Genesis account. So how else do you explain this progression towards distortion, both in time and geography, unless all the peoples of the world did indeed migrate out of Mesopotamia into all the parts of the earth? And later on, I'm going to share with you how we can also document that spread of humanity through domesticated grain. They're now able to employ DNA testing on different grains to document when that grain was first used for large-scale agriculture. And what do you see? The stuff moves in concentric circles out of northern Mesopotamia into all the parts of the earth. Okay, I'm supposed to close off. Yeah, but go ahead. Yes. Right.
What that brings up is a question having to do with all of the flood stories. How do we know those came from the original first flood, the original record, rather than one of these later floods that was long enough only to be the record?
Well, okay. What you see in the different flood stories is that every single one of them speaks about this flood as being utterly catastrophic. Only a few people survive. And in all these flood stories, you got this boat or barge that shows up, which is a source of rescue for the few people that make it out. But yeah, after the Genesis flood, and presumably before the Genesis flood, you would have large floods, probably not as deep. Probably like what happened in the San Joaquin Valley, where you've got this flood just covering that whole area for a long period of time. It might have destroyed several cities and villages, but it wasn't something that wiped out the whole human race. And so you would get a deposit being left there. Particularly as you get into southern Mesopotamia, floods there were quite common. Now they're not because we dam up the rivers, but in the days before they did that. And by the way, those ancient civilizations often encouraged the flooding, because it was, you know, good for the agriculture. Let's let the waters flood, and we'll just move out of the way while that happens. And then once the flood is over, we're going to have some really fertile land in which to grow crops. So, until recently, that was done in Egypt. You know, just let the Nile flood, and we'll grow new crops. And there's some concern now that the productivity of Egypt will drop precipitously if they stop using heavy loads of fertilizer, because there's no nutrients coming from the Nile River anymore. Okay. Father in heaven, thank you for this time we've had in this passage. And Father, I thank you that this is a passage that draws so much attention from non-Christians. It's a passage that draws so much discussion by Christians as they debate amongst themselves. Lord, I pray that you would help us to become wise and gracious in the use of this content to open up a door for people to hear the claims of Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior over their lives. Lord, help us to find better ways to make that bridge, to draw your people in. In Jesus' name, amen.